Beyond Brunel, talking about the future of infrastructure in the Southwest from the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership, supported by ICE Southwest.
Welcome back to Beyond Brunel. Today we're focusing on one of the most defining aspects of life in the Southwest, our stunning natural landscapes. To discuss tourism, landscape and infrastructure, I'm joined in the studio by Julian Gray, Director of the Southwest Coast Path Association and Chair of National Trails UK. And dialing in is Dr. Catherine Broomfield, Vice Chair of the Trustees at the Campaign for National Parks. Welcome, Julian, and welcome, Catherine.
Thank you for inviting us along.
Nice to be here, and thank you for having me.
We're so lucky in the Southwest to have two UNESCO World Heritage Sites, a UNESCO Geopark, a UNESCO Biosphere, the first National Marine Park, two of the world's largest natural harbours, two national parks, and 10 national landscapes, not to mention the 630-mile-long Southwest Coast Path. The question is, Catherine, when does a natural asset become a piece of infrastructure?
When we value it as such. I don't think the natural asset has changed, has it? It's the way we perceive it in terms of people working in this space and in terms of driving policy. We need to perceive it and communicate it as infrastructure because, apart from its intrinsic value, it is an enabler of so many things that we need to achieve for the well-being of our society and the sustainability of our society, of the climate and of our economy. And that's why it's bringing together this idea of sustainable economic development and nature recovery. The two things aren't two separate ideas. They're part of the same curve.
Julian, do you think the public recognise our green assets as pieces of infrastructure?
Quick answer, no, but they do recognise the value of those assets. And we're starting to understand the public benefits of those assets more and more. And I think if you go back to 1948, we had the creation under the Bevan administration of the National Health Service. In 1949, we had the legislation which created our national parks and national landscapes and national trails. And that was really about connecting people to nature and addressing what at the time was seen as a nature crisis, but also a public crisis following a very traumatic period. Well, come forward 75 years, and we're in exactly the same situation, but we also have climate change added in on top, which is really exacerbating that climate impact on the nature crisis. So I think people understand the value of being outdoors. People now understand, I think, from the lockdowns in COVID, how important being able to get outside is, and whereas historically there might have been a kind of like a paradigm or a view of being outdoors as being a solitary solo act, during COVID it was seen as one of the few safe places where you could be sociable. And I think that's a real shift in how we think about our natural assets. Working in the industry, we know how important it is, but now we're getting a lot more research from universities like University of Exeter and the like, which would really help us articulate what those public benefits are.
And while the public might be more aware of the benefits and the assets, is it true to say that that's reflected in the funding, the views of politicians?
It's starting to be, but it's a very long journey. And I think as a sector, the environment sector and the national parks, trails and landscapes haven't been brilliant about engaging in what those public benefits have been to policymakers and specifically to funders. And I think over the past 4 or 5 years, there's been quite a shift following the Glover Review, which looked at our protected landscapes, and the national parks, the national landscapes, the national trails are now working better together with Natural England and with DEFRA to engage with Treasury to make sure we do get the proper funding we need to be able to manage, conserve and enhance these amazing assets.
Obviously, there's no silver bullet to this. There's no one thing that's going to fix everything. I think so many roads lead back to the investment question. And, you know, CMP just published a major report, which was a health check on National Park in England and Wales. And National Park authorities have had their budgets slashed nearly by half over the past few years. And so much of the question here is on providing the necessary funding.
Picking up on that point, it's really helpful to get the Council for National Parks report on this. It helps highlight the direction we need to go, and it builds on the work of the Glover Review and previous reviews. I think there's two separate elements to it. One of them is the managers of those designations. So the national park managers, the national trail managers, and the national landscape managers are better articulating the need for the resources they need to be able to engage with all the other people who are actually delivering those landscapes. The challenge will be is post-CAP and post-Brexit, whether or not we will get the right mechanisms built into all the environmental land management schemes and the countryside steward and stewardship and all those other programs. That's where the big money is. So we can get some funds to be able to deliver our services, but the big money is in those agri-environment schemes. Also, we've obviously lost our European funding mechanisms, and it's not clear yet where those large infrastructure funds are going to come from government, and big question about funding with government altogether anyway for the next 3, 4, 5 years. And there's also a conceptual problem, because although we can normally argue to be able to get funding for capital expenditure, one of our biggest challenges is revenue. So if I give you an example, maintaining the Southwest Coast Path, 1,000 kilometres of trail, which needs to be managed and cut back, just looking at vegetation growth, because we're getting wetter and warmer climates, we're having to cut back more often. That's costing us more money, and we're trying to get the resources to be able to do that. And we can't do that because there isn't the revenue funding. We can get capital expenditure to do physical improvements to the infrastructure, but not just to maintain it. We've got to work out how we unlock those funds with Treasury.
And we know that Dartmoor National Park is expanding, 858 acres of common land recently purchased through grant funding via DEFRA. But I wonder, is grant funding enough, and how sustainable it is to maintain and operate our green spaces, given that we're living in this cost of living crisis? Perhaps I could get your thoughts on that, Catherine.
It really speaks to the point that Julian made, is that what we all need is to have the ability to plan long term and to know that we have that ongoing revenue to be able to make improvements, but then maintain those improvements. And that's what we really need, is to have that baseline security to do the year-on-year work, not just the one-offs, because we know then that long-term is very difficult to sustain that improvement. One of the other things I would just also talk about, the real big delivery area in terms of our protected landscapes is so much obviously linked with the farmers and landowners in those areas, and sometimes they're part of the problem. Very often, they definitely can be part of the solution. And farmers are facing a really uncertain time at the moment. A lot of farmers in our protected landscapes are going to see a massive reduction in their income as we change from the pre-Brexit CAP to the new environmental land management schemes. We've seen time-bound schemes like the Farming in Protected Landscapes, the FIPL scheme, which has been really effective in bringing farmers together to do good work in protected landscapes, but that's now due to end. We really need to push government to put more of that long-term funding in to replace that short-term scheme, which has proven itself to be successful.
Yeah, and to pick up that point about the importance of programs like the Farming in Protected Landscapes, the FIPL scheme, it's been brilliant that it's been set up. It's only had short-term funding, and it's only within the protected landscapes. So in the southwest, we're lucky in that about 70% of the coast is covered by some form of designation, but 30% isn't. So that means there's quite a significant area which is not getting those opportunities that the protected landscapes are. And quite often, those are the areas which are on the margins to communities. So the urban fringe style, but across a range of communities from cities like Plymouth right through to Cornish fishing villages. And those intersections of where people are and how they get to and through those protected landscapes is really important. And we need to invest in those spaces, because if we're going to meet the environmental improvement plan's target of every household having access to green or blue space within 15 minutes, we need those routes and we need those access points. And we need to rethink how we open up access and how we deal with access and connecting people to nature in our planning system as well.
But Julian's quite right to point out that it's really critical that the places in between also are valued and have the same sort of policies and investment on them, because it's those connectivities for people and for nature that really make the thing work. And it would just be nice to have a conversation about our natural green and blue infrastructure as a complete piece across the region and not differentiated in this way, sort of sliced and diced as protected landscapes and then landscape that apparently doesn't need protection. I think in an ideal world, that would be the framing of the conversation.
Julian, I want to pick up this point about the number of people that are affected by green infrastructure positively. And I suppose that goes for the grey belt as well, that point you made where green infrastructure meets urban realm. We have these corridors. There's a lot of people affected, different landowners, different stakeholders. So how do we create a unified voice across the region when we're talking about infrastructure, whether it's green or grey?
I think the conversation has already started. And also, I think a lot of people who are working and living in the Southwest understand the value of this green infrastructure. So for a good example, the Southwest Business Council recognise green infrastructure and support those organisations who are working in the space. The Southwest Tourism Awards, the National Parks, Landscapes and Trails all won a commendation for the outstanding contribution to tourism that they provide. If I pick up on the Southwest Coast Path, because that's obviously my area of speciality, we drive about 5% of the tourism industry in the Southwest. It's over £500 million. So that's supporting over 10,000 jobs. And that might sound like they're large numbers, but we have 9 million people using the trail every year. So you can kind of understand where those numbers are coming from. So purely from a Treasury perspective, you would look at and say, OK, that's about 100 million going back into Treasury coffers just from VAT receipts. They're investing 500,000 into the trail every year. So that's why the third sector has had to come in and actually try and help and engage and do fundraising and engage with local businesses to try and match those funds and to bring in new funding to be able to deliver. But if we're delivering, say, £520 million worth of tourism, we're also delivering something in the region of £75 million worth of health benefits just from people are slightly healthier because they're walking the trail and therefore they're living a little bit longer. So we're using things like the World Health Organization heat model there and the University of East Anglia's Qualys research. So those numbers start to then pick up a picture of how much economic value we are delivering and then what the potential is going forward. And if you then talk about, and I don't want to talk about natural capital per se, but the value of those natural assets. And we've got to be slightly careful we don't get into number counting just in those spaces, because we could end up having the same kind of consequences that we've had with some of the carbon accounting programs, which end up with consequences you don't necessarily want. But if we value those natural assets, we need to invest and we need businesses to engage in that too. So there needs to be conversations and things like this podcast will help.
Catherine, no doubt we'll circle around on some of these key themes, investment, health, and indeed tourism. But I just want to pick up that point on health that Julian was making. Do you think enough emphasis is placed on supporting either existing or developing new green infrastructure, given that we know it supports things like mental health and indeed carbon capture and active travel?
I think we're moving in the right direction. If we think back, certainly pre-pandemic, the conversation about nature and access to nature being something that supports all of our mental well-being, it wasn't really discussed, certainly not in a policy context. And I think now that is very much changed. I think the narrative's changed. It is recognised. There's an awful lot of work to do because there's also a natural tension between these things. You know, and we saw it during COVID in particular. People really understood or just felt the need instinctively to go and connect with nature and get out into beautiful open spaces and countryside and parks in towns, anywhere where we have some green nature. And we know there's a sort of tension between how do we manage that as a good thing, but we need to make sure that we manage it in a way that is sustainable. And I think in transport links is a really key issue. It's not an easy one, but it's something that we really need to come together and have conversations about that. We really need to focus a lot on getting young people connected with our natural spaces, our protected landscapes, and making it a real focus, a priority that we help them to do that, which is something we're working with others in this area at CMP on, in really trying to give young people their voice in having agency about how we look after our protected landscapes going forward in terms of its value on well-being on nature and as people as part of nature. One statistic in terms of climate change, we've got something like 40% of the peatlands in England and Wales are within our national parks. And about 70% plus of those peatlands are not in a good condition. There's so many fantastic opportunities where we can just give some real focus to policy and investment that we can get some really big wins.
It's interesting hearing those kind of numbers. Also thinking, I mean, here we are, or here I am in Plymouth, and if you go to some of the northern parts of the city and you go into the schools and talk with kids there, 50% of them haven't been to the beach. This is Britain's ocean city as branded. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping the new branding around the National Marine Park will help do some of that engagement and get young people reconnected and re-engage with what is an amazing natural environment around the city. There is a move to things like social prescribing, and there's some very good structures being put into the health systems to be able to deliver those, but they're only going down to the point of the people giving out the prescriptions at the moment, and the actual delivery of the prescriptions on the ground. The people are actually going out and leading walks or leading whatever those activities are that are connecting to people to nature aren't properly funded, and they're not developed to a consistent quality standard or set of standards yet. And that really is an opportunity that we need to pick up on and work with the health sector to make sure we can deliver that properly.
I think there's a huge opportunity here because our new Labour government, they've very much put a focus to date on upstream interventions in policy rather than downstream. So being proactive in creating a pro-health environment rather than trying to deal with all the problems that come out of an unhealthy environment. And that's very much connected to the food we produce, but it's also very much connected to making sure that we have our infrastructure in a good condition to enable people to live healthy lives in healthy ways. And I think we've really got to push the conversation, you know, the policy and the investment conversation upstream and try and be more proactive in these areas.
Beyond Brunel, talking about the future of infrastructure in the Southwest. From the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership, supported by ICE Southwest. Search for us on LinkedIn.
Julian, you made a really good point there about working in silos. It's something we've covered as part of the podcast before, and indeed is talked about in the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership Southwest Vision. I wonder who's responsible, though, for ensuring consistency in our approach to maintaining and making accessible green infrastructure assets. We know where they are. Many of them are protected, as you've said, but it's really about that implementation piece, isn't it?
It is. And it's interesting in that historically that has been done in silos, and now we're trying to develop the systems and the processes and the funding streams to be able to work better in partnership. So following the Glover Review in 2019, we've now set up a Protected Landscapes Partnership, and that partnership has received funding from DEFRA to drive work forward across two streams, one of which is the whole piece about equity of access and diversity and inclusion, so the connecting people to nature part, and the other part is about nature recovery. Now, there's loads of work and loads of different programs delivering nature recovery, and I think our role through the Protected Landscapes Partnership is to try and join those bits together, because we've got farm clusters, we've got local nature recovery schemes, we've got nature partnerships. There's a whole range in landscape recovery programs, and it's finding where those are working, giving examples of best practice and exemplars, and again, finding the gaps and joining those gaps together and building those connections and those corridors between those different pieces of infrastructure.
And Catherine, this is a big question, potentially challenging, but we know that investment is a challenge for the region and indeed for green infrastructure in general, being recognised as assets and breaking down those silos. The north of England has benefited from the Northern Powerhouse. I wonder, in the southwest, have we really got such a thing as the natural powerhouse? And can we capitalise on that for investment?
Probably not at this point. It's a good point, you know, in that I think we really need to, in terms of generally the squeeze on public finances that we've all been made acutely aware of, you know, I think the whole narrative around the transition, say, from the energy industry actually being an investment in green jobs is a driver of the economy. I think we really need to, particularly in these peripheral areas, as we are in the Southwest, we really need to push that message that investment in our green infrastructure is a driver of the economy and health and well-being, and to see it as an investment and as part of the commitment to reducing our impact on global warming. It's all critical parts of the big policy picture. So I think we really need to not discuss this in terms of being an overhead and a nice to have, but it's a big driver of social change in the economy. We haven't had that focus regionally, perhaps, as they have in the North, in being able to articulate that with one voice as a green powerhouse, which the Southwest is fantastically well placed to do. And I think every major player in the region understands the opportunity.
And agree 100% with that. And I think it's a challenge that we need to push up to structures and organisations such as the Great Southwest. We should be seeing green infrastructure as one of those key five drivers that they've got in the Southwest. At the moment, we're not. So that's a challenge. So there still is some persuasion to be done regionally. There's some interesting work that's happening on a national basis, which is going to help us, looking at how we do better engage communities and investments and local businesses into protecting and enhancing their local environment. Looking at tourism sector and social license to operate and a whole range of issues, which we could go into. So I think there's some great opportunities there, but we do need that strong regional voice, which I'm not sure we have at the moment.
There is some really interesting work taking place, seminal work beginning to emerge. I mean, there's some interesting work within the University of Exeter down at the Penryn campus, mainly where they're looking at co-joining, as it were, nature recovery and regional economic development, working with councils. There's 11 councils across the UK, I think it's 11, which are in the peripheral areas, and looking at what that opportunity is for the green economy in these peripheral areas. And I think that's the kind of thinking that is going to really help us bring forward, as you phrased it, the green powerhouse approach, where we recognise the nature recovery and regional economic development aren't two silos never to connect, but they're absolutely interwoven. And it's our secret ingredient in a region like the Southwest for our economy, for our people, for our nature. They're all mutually bound.
That's quite interesting. You kind of pick up on the peripheral element there, because there are programs like in South Devon, the Life on the Edge project. And the whole idea is, because we're on the edge, because we are impacted by climate change, probably in a more obvious way, because it doesn't matter what direction a storm comes in, it's going to hit some part of the coast and we're going to get some impact on our infrastructure, that we may actually use that rather than as a weakness, see it as a strength, that we are on the edge and we are able to see those issues and be able to come up with innovative solutions to be able to address the impacts of climate change and nature crisis in the Southwest.
So that leads perfectly into talking a little bit about climate change. And we know that our natural assets, green infrastructure, can help to reduce flood risk, to capture carbon. And we know that there's also many pathfinder projects going on in the Southwest. We've heard about the use of beavers and so on for retaining and attenuating floodwater. But I wonder, are we doing more harm than good? And are we being allowed to fail with some of those projects?
I would say at the moment, the projects that are being trialled seem to be working reasonably well and are good exemplar projects. I think there's lots more that we can do. And in terms of the impacts of climate change, we should be able to articulate better what those impacts are. So in terms of managing the Southwest Coast Path, we're seeing our costs have probably gone up by 50% in the past 2 or 3 years above inflation. So it's actually, you know, gone up significantly more because inflation has been so high. And that's because we're getting more frequent storms, and that's impacting on coastal erosion. But we're also getting heavier weather events, which are then leading to local flood events. And we're also getting things like storms taking out trees and woodlands, which are in themselves protecting the green infrastructure as well as being part of the green infrastructure. And we're getting, like last summer, we had wildfires, which did significant short-term damage, but also undermined some of the local structure of the coastal trails. So all these things are adding to our costs, and we need to be able to draw on more and more of the programs, such as restoration projects, where we're looking at how to manage floodwater in a more natural way and go back to those natural processes. Some great work happening up in, say, the Tamar Valley, and the Environment Agency also investing significant amounts in this kind of space, which is brilliant.
And Catherine, I wonder, how do we balance adaptation with intervention when we talk about green infrastructure? We know that with climate change, Julia was talking about erosion risk, that as communities, we will have to adapt in the future. But clearly, something like the South West Coast Path is a tourist attraction in its own right. It brings investment to the region. So do we continue to intervene and to protect those sorts of assets? Or do we make sacrifices, move them inland? How do we balance those different choices?
I think everything is always in the balance, isn't it? That's where everything lies. You know, people's need to have livelihoods, to have a flourishing local economy, but to do so in a way that's not detrimental to the natural world on which we're all reliant for our livelihoods or just our basic health and well-being and existence. I don't know if I have a really easy answer for that, but I think it has to really be taken by a case-by-case basis. You know, whether you're looking at what kind of defences to put in coastal areas, you know, against erosion of coastlines, or whether you're looking at how to intervene to provide paths and access routes in protected landscapes to allow people to have access to it. Because clearly the balance needs to be there in that we don't use it. And if we don't be in it, then that's what really causes people to care for it. And that's why I think facilitating carefully thought through interventions to enable access is really critical, that we do find that balance, because we can't just dissuade and tell people that, sorry, there's too many of you and you can't be here. We need to find a way of allowing them to access the countryside without leaving too big a footprint.
Just picking up on the specifics, as you mentioned, you know, what the impacts with the South West Coast Path, we're very lucky in that we've now got the legislative tools to be able to address those issues in a better way. So the Marine and Coastal Access Act 2009 gives us basically a rollback opportunity where we can push the trail inland in the face of coastal erosion. But it also is giving us new open access, similar to the Countryside and Rights of Way Act 2000, which is the open access land that you get on Mountain Moor, Heath and Down. We now have that for the whole of the England coast. Now, there obviously are exceptions to that, but that's going to be 800 square miles of new land where we are going to be able to connect people to nature. And our challenge is doing it in ways which allow nature to thrive, allow people to connect to nature, but also without damaging nature. And so you might have areas where you have perceived access rather than physical access, like you can stand on a viewpoint and see things as opposed to get in there with the seals, which would be obviously a bad thing to do.
And is that a way that we can get around this growing demand to access our natural assets? Because we're seeing increase in visitor numbers post-COVID. We all know of people who might have moved to the region to seek that better lifestyle. And of course, it's bound to place pressure on those assets.
Yeah. The big challenges are sustainable access in terms of physically how you get to those places. And sustainable transport is a real key issue, and we need to be better connected in that space. In terms of carrying capacity, yes, there's one or two honeypot sites, which we can all probably name off as being incredibly busy in the summer. But you can easily walk 2 miles from any car park on the South West Coast Path, and even on a busy summer's day, you are going to bump into very few people. So there is the opportunity. It's just finding the ways to engage people and show them what those opportunities are.
I think there's a couple of things here. I mean, one thing is we talk about infrastructure. Sometimes we can forget the bit that makes all this really work, which is the people, the people part of the infrastructure. And, you know, I think that as we see this pressure on our protected landscapes in the national parks, for example, you know, we're CMP are calling for a national park ranger service, because a lot of the issues and some of the tensions that arise around increased use of our protected landscapes are really partly because people, they're not necessarily aware of all the issues. They're not aware of it's okay to be and where it's not okay to be. And when people do understand and they are supported in that way, I think the vast majority of people are really respectful of that. And I think having a proper ranger service in national parks would be a really key enabling tool to help us manage access, increasing and growing access, which is actually what we want, but to do it in a way that's sustainable. And I also think there's another point here, which is about going back to the earlier conversation that we had, Julian, is about the corridors and the interconnectivity. And when you have these honeypot, these ring-fenced sites, you're driving people to these designated sites. And actually what we need is to have really easy access to nature, which is also in these sites and between these sites, so that people can access nature near where they live, takes the pressure off the transport issue, and that they can also enjoy really high quality natural environments in protected landscapes and also between protected landscapes. I think that mosaic is part of what helps to make it sustainable.
And that's a really important point. And it's quite interesting, this conversation isn't just happening in the Southwest. There's an international conversation, whereas historically trails, especially in the US national parks, like, have been seen as a way of allowing people to get access to places which have been ring-fenced off as protected sites or protected areas. But the whole design of the trail is to minimise the impact of people in those spaces. To a broader conversation, which is now happening with the IUCN, the International Union for Nature Conservation, and the World Trails Network, which is really looking at how trails are being used to drive sustainability, to drive reforestation, to drive sustainable livelihoods, and look at those, how you can use the trail brand and the creation of the trail and the management of the trail to support local communities to deliver a really high quality, nature rich environment which supports livelihoods. And there's some fantastic examples, like around Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. You've got some new trails which are connecting a series of national parks together, which are all community driven. Over in Costa Rica, you've got new trails coming out of the cloud forest, going right the way down through pastulands down to the Pacific coast, which are driving reforestation of biosphere reserves. So there's some fantastic stuff. And in the Southwest, we're trying to take that kind of approach, and we're looking with partners to try and develop what we're calling a wider and a wilder coast. And we're putting it under the brand of the Coastal Wild Belt. National Trust, who are a major landowner in the area, they're part of that, and they're delivering some amazing restoration work and connection work with communities. So we've got some real opportunities here, and it's taking that bigger picture and trying to rethink how we, or reimagine how we address these, what people have historically perceived as threats, and see them as opportunities.
So, Julian, I want to pick up on these themes of interconnectivity and access, because they do seem to be really important and they've run through our entire conversation. According to a report by the Heart of Southwest LEP, up to 60% of employment associated with tourism is in rural areas, which of course is often where we've got these natural assets. So getting people to and from these locations in a sustainable way is often as important as protecting the sites themselves. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. And it's also an important infrastructure conversation. But this is obviously transport infrastructure and how we make sure the transport infrastructure and the green infrastructure work hand in hand. And that's more about how we better connect those different services. So we're already seeing down in Plymouth Sound, we've got a growing ferry network which joins to bus networks, and it starts to connect and makes it easier for people to get around without relying on driving around the area, which is a far better way of seeing the Southwest.
Thanks again to my guests today. That was a really fascinating conversation with lots of key takeaways. My guests were Julian Gray from the Southwest Coast Path Association and Dr. Catherine Broomfield from the Campaign for National Parks. And thank you for listening.
You've been listening to Beyond Brunel from the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership, supported by ICE Southwest. Search for us on LinkedIn. Beyond Brunel is presented by Christopher Ackland, a Fresh Air Studios production.